since this is the last session of this year, I would like to make an announcement about the next Sakpa session, which will be on January the 8th on Thursday, as usual, from noon. The subject of discussion is oil sand and environmental management. And the speaker is Shannon Flint. She is the Executive Director of a Strategic Policy and Innovation with the Oil Sands Environmental Management Division of Alberta Environment. Does that mean provincial government? Thank you. So she's coming here. It's a topical issue. And I am sure you have many questions about this particular development of natural resource. That will be January the 8th, Thursday at 1 o'clock here at the Country Kitchen Catering. 10 o'clock, $10 as usual. Like I said, don't stop eating. And our speaker was busy being interviewed by a reporter, so she's still eating. I wonder, we'd like to go into a question and answer period. So, do you mind starting it, Claudia? Starting the next session? Are you done? Excellent. All right. There is a microphone out there for people who want to ask questions. I want you to line up so that there'll be a little time in between questions. And then will you please start by asking one question? If you have two questions, would you mind waiting until next time around? And try to limit your comment as short as possible. Comments should be preamble for the question. So, I don't see anybody standing there. So, can we all go home? Maybe you're waiting for dessert? Ian. Okay.
Hi, is this on?
It's on.
My name's Ian McKenna, and Claudia, thanks a lot for coming down. The question I have is really one for today, you know.
Right.
The people that were in that institution, you know, nowadays we accommodate people in workplaces. You know, we've sort of got rid of the old medical model, you know, that you're disabled if you've got some kind of condition. But forgetting it's because we exclude people generally from our normal society that this happens. And I just wonder, you know, how many people in those days could have been accommodated, you know, outside the Michener. You know, does that sort of make sense, that kind of question?
It's a really good question, actually, Ian. And I'm almost reluctant to answer it because we can go down that path of saying, oh my God, there were actually people in Michener Center who shouldn't have been there, when in reality nobody should have probably been there. But there were many people who came to Michener Center who actually didn't have disabilities at all, whose families were impoverished, or whose families were Eastern European or First Nations. Those populations were highly overrepresented in Michener's population. And I interviewed people who had polio, who had just missed 3 or 4 years of schooling, and then were not accommodated when they came back into their communities in their schools, and so were sent to Michener Center to catch up on their educations there. Michener didn't open because it was a training or employment place. It opened because it was a school. So for the first decades of its existence, it was for children only. It was only when they realized that they were actually disabled enabling people further in the institution, and they needed to build adult facilities, that they built Deer Home, which housed about 1,200 people. So that's a question. The question as you pose it is unanswerable, but many people who think that the Commissioner of Security could have lived in community fully without any support at different points.
I'm Beth Mendel-Atherstone. Thank you very much for your talk. I particularly found it fascinating how Red Deer grew and benefited from the Michener Center. I always wondered how Red Deer could be such a big place out there, sort of so close to Edmonton, and wondered what was the prime force behind it. I guess I'm quite concerned about the mean-spiritedness and the Calvinistic attitude that not only was shown then, but continues into our own society, as exemplified by the very low payments to people on AISH. And I wondered if you would like to comment on the current findings in the AISH report. And what you think about that?
Well, there's a big push in much welfare state reform to have people get to work. That's a big push. And there are many advantages to employment. But I guess the fear on many disability groups' part is that this will be mandatory in order to obtain benefits. So I'm not sure what you're really alluding to. AISH had a review in 2005. I think we remember Mr. Klein's debacle in the media where he said that you don't look disabled to me as the review was going on, and basically throwing that kind of smoke screen about, oh, you're smoking and you know you're having way too good a life on AISH was part of the rhetoric when that review first opened up. And now people who are on AISH are allowed to work without losing their benefits, but not very much before your benefits begin to go down. So there's a cost balance that always has to be played off.
$200.
It's $200, so it's not a heck of a lot of money, and then it starts chipping away. And then you reach a certain point, and if you work too much, then you're at risk of losing your health benefits, which for many people is in the many thousands of dollars a year. So there is a sort of there's on the one hand a punitive kind of rhetoric about people who are on state support and their dependency, and on the other hand, there are programs that don't really permit people to achieve true dignity in their lives. So it's kind of a Occam's razor in that way. Is that sort of where you were hoping it would go?
Hi, thanks. My name is Bridget Pasteur. Claudia, thank you very much. Moira Watson is my executive assistant, has been speaking about you many times, and so I'm pleased to come and listen because I don't think we've ever met before.
No.
A couple of my comments would be that I continue every month to donate to a food bank because AISH simply must be indexed, as are MLA salaries. And AISH still has not caught up to where they should be. And I'll just make another correction. Actually, they're allowed to make $400 a month.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, my question to you, and I guess it will come in a form of a comment. I mean, what can you do when you're a politician, right? Anyway. My concern, my concern is that finally we've gotten around, I'm not saying that the government's attitude still is where it should be, but we've finally gotten around to saying, you know what, yes, we can have people inclusive in our communities, yes, they're capable of work, yes, we can get them to their full potential, but I still say that there are many who are severely brain injured, who are severely physically handicapped, and I'm so afraid that they are going to get lost in the mix because A, they need increased staffing, and they need staffing that's trained, and that costs money. And so that's sort of the little group that I'm hoping won't get lost and that I'm still fighting for. So I'm wondering where you see that attitude, like we still have to, there are some people that have to be looked after 24 hours a day in our society. They will never work, and they will never be able to go on what their particular disability is at this point. So I wonder if you could maybe make a comment on that little group that falls under the big umbrella.
That's an interesting question. I mean, I just was speaking with the fellow from the Lethbridge Herald, and he was asking, you know, who's in Michener Center? And the people who are living in Michener Center now, generally, not all, but quite a few of them would be the kind of people that you're describing. Are there people who left Michener in the early 70s, had a couple of decades of life outside, and are aging and unwell and are back in the institution because they don't have community supports? I think that people, even those people who are living in Michener Center, could be living in community in ways that are quite innovative. I don't know if you know Bruce Yuditsky at Alberta Association for Community Living, but they've got some fairly profoundly disabled people who they facilitate full and meaningful lives with. It takes a lot of energy and it takes a lot of money. And just speaking about money, I just think that one of the things that really needs to be said is that people who work with people who have disabilities, especially outside of the institution, are abysmally paid and are abysmally looked after in that way. And it creates all kinds of possibilities for abuse and neglect there too. So this is a much bigger problem than coming up with what Claudia thinks, because I've always got an opinion, but it's not always right apparently. But I think all of those elements need to be considered in concert with one another. I still believe, as I think the current PDD board would agree, who are in the business of running Michener today, that when the last person leaves, the key should be thrown away.
Yes, Albert Clay. I'd just like to know if there's any check put on the genetic side of this, and if there is any reason for checks. When you do have these, let's call them difficulties in life, and there's no check on getting married or having sexual intercourse with you, between these people, is that not a danger for the next generation?
Gee, that's a big question. Well, my personal ethics would say that there's no need for such a thing. I am currently, I have two research programs going on. One is this historical piece with Michener Center, but I also interview parents who have disabilities, and among those people are people who have brain injuries and intellectual disabilities and severe physical disabilities. I've interviewed a woman who's a quadriplegic as the result of a motor vehicle accident. She had her baby before she had her accident. Life intervenes. Somebody can hit you on the head with a hammer and away you go, and you've got two or three kids. So I think we'd love to believe that life is predictable and manageable and controllable, and that if we could just sort of manage the gene pool, we wouldn't have those problems. But I think that's a difficult assumption to rely on. But this woman who is quadriplegic has got full-time care in the home. She directs the management of her home. She is at home with her child almost full-time, except that she's completing a law degree at this moment. And she is running a life as a single parent. And the reason that she's able to do this is because her accident happened when she was at work. And I think we can all understand that when I say workers' compensation is the best way to become disabled in this country, that's a shocking thing to say, right? Because workers' compensation, people drive through your front window and try and shoot you when you're running the reception office. So she managed to have her disability happen while she was at work. And she's got enough paid care and paid support that she can actually run a decent life. So I think, not to be too Pollyanna, but I think it's possible for things to work. And there are plenty of able-bodied people whose children are neglected and uncared for. We can't assume that genetics are going to take care of business.
I'm Trevor Page. Thanks for your presentation. And as you said in your introduction, it is historical. And I know you've made it before in other fora. And I guess contributed to a change of approach to people with disabilities as far as Michener Center is concerned. My question deals with how the Michener Center, before it was reformed, compared with centers in other developed countries, and I'm talking about Europe and possibly the US, but the US is rather unique in the way it incarcerates people. But in comparing it with Europe, and whether the changes in Europe, in fact, are similar to those that currently exist at Michener, or whether you still, or whether you feel, if you know, that there is a long way to go to come up with an enlightened policy towards people with disabilities.
That's a really good question. Institutions sprang up across North America, the UK, and Northern Europe in the late teens and early 20s. With this idea, there was a sort of a great enthusiasm and a great optimism that there could be, that difference could be educated out of people. You know, if we just found the right way to come up with a program, we'd be able to get rid of any kind of problems that they have, not that we have as a society to accommodate, but that they have in meeting societal expectations. And of course, you know, that was a doomed to failure kind of a movement because its expectations were ridiculous. And politics and economics of the 30s really led to more draconian kind of ideas. Institutions grew tremendously right through until the 1970s. And actually, Finland right now is just commencing its deinstitutionalization program. So they've still got institutions in Finland that look a lot like Michener looked in 70. So, you know, it's not over. It's not over at all.
My name is Tom Kane, and I'd like to thank you for your presentation and your recently stated opinion. You don't think anybody needed to live in Michener Center. In the 80s, I was working part-time for the Alberta Association on bringing people out of Michener Center.
Right.
And we were told that, you know, some were too, quote, medically fragile. So there was one mom here from Southern Alberta. I'll just tell you briefly about her and then ask you a question. She has two children that, when they were youngsters, had severe, quote, challenges in life. The medical doctor 38 years ago said, you've got to send one of them to Michener Center. You can't possibly keep them both at home. So she broke her heart and sent Calvin, who died last week. So
I didn't know.
He's been on my mind, and I spoke at his funeral. And he went to Michener for 18 years. The last 20 years, he came home and was reunited with his sister, lived in the same home, and he didn't live with his sister from age 7 to 24. They missed each other all through those formative years, and that was his loneliness and his heartbreak that his mother had to follow the medical advice. So I think Calvin, I can say his name publicly because there were two TV programs here in Southern Alberta about Calvin, the channels 2 and 7 did. One, it took 4 years to plan to get him out and get him back reunited with his family, and then when he came home. So this question really for Calvin. We partially were interested in him because of Sylvia's broken heart, and her heart is no longer broken. She had 20 good years. When Calvin was born, she was told he'd only lived about 1 year. When we bring him out of Michener Center, we had to sign special waiver forms that was our responsibility if he died while we were bringing him out. Calvin thrived on the little plane that we sent up to get him with the nurse and his mom. Sylvia, the mom, got sick on the way home in the plane. So Calvin is quite a survivor, but he was one of those people that people would have argued he could never live outside of the institution. And we proved that one wrong, so I don't think anybody needs to live there. My question to you is, today you talked a lot about inmates and you're doing the historical thing, and you used the terminology that the government used. Exploitation and will help out the economy of Red Deer. What about what people contribute as a person? Calvin didn't have any way to contribute, but at his funeral there were all sorts of people who in his quiet way he contributed to making their life better last week. When he was in Michener Center, nobody really cared. And his abilities went way downhill in this training center where he was supposed to get better. In your research, will you write that up as a book? And will you have a chapter on not inmates or economic exploited something statistics, or people who were good for the economy of Red Deer, but will you have something on the people who live there as people? How about a chapter in your book, if you ever get to a book, on people first and what they contribute to society, not from the economic perspective? There's so many other perspectives besides the economy, which is falling apart because we didn't do it right anyway.
Well, I think I agree with you. I just, in my own defense, I actually was a contributor to Hear Our Voices, so you know, which is a book that is about the people who survived Ed Michener and about their lives afterwards. So, you know, I get that. I think that it's important to talk about economics because it's like, in some ways, it's like here we are again, and we're looking at tough economic times. There will be a book, and this is only a chapter thereof. But I think that it's also important that to understand that history has a little tendency to repeat itself. And that when, you know, times are tough, then people get quite cruel and corners get cut and programs. I mean, as we know, with the last premier of this province, you know, when somebody wants to make a difference in a negative way, it can happen really quickly, and all those hard fought gains get clawed away pretty readily. So I agree with you. It's important to acknowledge humanness. But I, in my own defense, I think there are ways to do that that are multiple. And while I contributed to Hear Our Voices, I also really, and this is going to sound cruel or cold, a limited market for that. We went and talked to the Chamber Center Board at Bruce and Houston and Central, going and seeing the grounds. They refused us. They refused to let us on the property. And that was what they said. Who would read this? Who would be interested in this story? And I think that what I want to do is make this story as interesting and as compelling in as many ways. And yes, there'll be people. I mean, the voices of people are present and foregrounded here. I don't want to go just to the archives, or I don't want to just talk to the people who worked at Michener Center or who ran it about what they think happened there, because it's a pretty sanitized version. Michener published its own history in 1985, and it sounds like a big picnic, you know, when you read it, and there's pictures of happy people in clays at Christmas time, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so by speaking to people, I hope to mitigate against that. But I also think that there are broader forces that need to be incorporated into the story about things like economies and philosophies of who is human and who is not, that need to be spoken to in those ways as well.
I'm Beverly Ravenstone, and I'm back for my second question. Okay, you've made a very good segue to the second question, and that is about who is human, who is considered to be part of society, and how our society tends to marginalize those who they don't consider to be fully human, as when women did not have the vote, and when Aboriginal people did not have the vote. And it seems to me when Rathkline opened up the institutions for people with mental illness and put them out on the street, that was a clear statement that people that don't have certain facilities, certain faculties, can just go out and die. So I'd like you to please comment about the group that you were telling me about in Edmonton, and what we are considering, what we as a society consider to be human or not human.
The group that you're alluding to is a research consortium out of the U of A, and we've just put forward a big, huge grant proposal, which I'm knocking on wood will come through. That is called the What Sorts Organization. One of the members of the consortium is Leilani Muir, who is an institutional survivor and a survivor of involuntary sterilization, and the woman who first acted as the first case against the provincial government for restitution prosecution for wrongful sterilization. And then there are a number of other people at the U of A and people in the States and the UK who are part of it, philosophers, historians, sociologists, and probably a psychologist or two. Maybe we had a couple of them. And we're looking to really look at cases, all kinds of cases, of who is human and who is not, or what kinds of things come up around that. So, for example, one of the things that we've been talking about on the website is eugenic history, but we've also been talking about a case in the UK where a mother has gone to the state and asked for the state to provide support for her to have her 9-year-old daughter's growth arrested at that age so that she won't have periods and she won't have to deal with becoming an adult woman, and in many ways it will facilitate her care. So she's talking about administering growth hormone, performing a hysterectomy, and keeping her as an eternal child. She refers to her as her pillow angel. And in the UK, the government has said no, they will not fund that. But there has been a case of a girl in the U.S. who has had this treatment done. And so this raises all kinds of ethical questions about who is human and what an entitlement to a certain kind of life ought to look like. So these are the kinds of cases that we've been looking at. Some of this stuff around the improper use of Depo Provera patches in return for welfare payments to inner city black American women, for example, fall under that umbrella as well. It's like, you can have your check, but you better not make any babies, is kind of the discussion. So there are wide-ranging cases, and while places like Michener form an historical basis for them, we can't be naive enough to believe that these things don't end there. So I hope we get the grant. You know, I think it's worth it.
My name is Van Christou, and I'd like to thank you for your presentation. The terms human and of course the economic consideration has been mentioned, but also the fact that we're talking about history so much, and it's so important. When we go back to when people lived in villages, I have a lot of fun visiting some of the old villages on the Greek islands, for example, where people look after these people in the village and have them live there. I'm wondering, do you not think that those people, we're talking about the people who are affected and how human they are, don't you think that the people who are looking after them are more human for having the presence of those people amongst them?
It's an interesting question. Jean Vanier, who is a former governor general of our country and responsible for establishing a network of community institutions called L'Arche, the Arch, has made that argument that people, and it's actually a pretty fabulous organization that still continues, where young people come and live and share and create a home together, some with disabilities, some without, and some with quite profound disabilities. And I think that's the argument that this is somehow elevating and improving to us. I would really, I guess, you know, I'm always the yeah but girl. So yeah but, I would like to just sort of caution against that we all get to be sanctified because we don't want to be bad, or because we you know, visit an old person at home, or you know, take a dog for a walk, or pat a disabled person on the wrist. You know, I mean, it's true. I have friends who have disabilities. Jeez, it sounds so horrible. I have friends who have disabilities, and my friendships with them enrich my life. But my friendships with my non-disabled friends enrich my life as well. And so I that's a good first step, but I'd like us to move to another step where it just is like not even on the agenda to think that way. We're so used to seeing people with disabilities living full and rich and contributing lives that they are us. They're not these people. They're us. That would be what I'd hope for Christmas this year. Yeah.
Do I
something.
Come over here.
I don't see anybody at the microphone. Does this mean that questions are exhausted? Now, I think Claudia deserves a round of applause, and thank you very much for coming. Like I said, she's on the study leave. She's not supposed to be working now, and she's on the way to England soon to do her research. I really am privileged to be able to call her friend. Anyhow, thank you very much for coming, and all of you will have wonderful Christmas, I'm sure, and the New Year, or Hanukkah, whatever you celebrate. I don't know what the Muslims celebrate. Eid. Eid. Sounds good. Eat well, don't drink too much. Thank you for coming.